Is now it.
Okay,
yeah. Are we back on?
Yeah.
All right, well, I just telling the story about Toby Sommer, who's a former student of Sam Danishevsky. He's now working at Brandeis, who wrote me after he read the book, and he said that he had been very interested in what I wrote about Thiele. One of the things I had in my book was a quotation from Willstetter, Willstetter's autobiography. And Toby read that, and for reasons that are too complicated to go into here, he was extremely interested in, now, exactly what kind of a guy was Thiele. So not only did he read what I had translated from my German copy of Willstetter's autobiography, but he went to the library and got a copy of the English translation of Willstetter's book, which I don't have and our library doesn't have. And he compared the professional translator's translation to mine, and he found a discrepancy. Now, well, so I had to write him back saying, look, I don't want to get into an argument with Hornig, Lily Hornig. She's a professional translator. I wouldn't presume to challenge her, but I would point out, and then I pointed out that she had translated, I think mistranslated, a word from Willstetter's book, which led to this switch in interpretation that caught Toby's eye and he was extremely interested in. Well, I'm not sure I convinced Toby, who doesn't know German, but in any case, that I could stop that steamroller, at least temporarily.
Well, let's get back onto the chronology.
Okay.
From Hoffman and LaRoche, you were taken at the Army.
Yeah.
And then the question is, what did you do in the Army? Were you able to use any of your chemistry there?
Well, not really. I ended up in the medical corps. And I was trained to be a combat medic, really. And I remember being told that we asked, well, aren't we going to get any weapons if we go into combat? They said, no, you don't go in and get any weapons. So we asked, well, how are we supposed to protect ourselves? They said, well, we gave you that little plastic card with a red cross on it. You're supposed to show this.
It
was very high. Well, fortunately, I never got exposed to that for complicated reasons. Because about the time that we were supposed to go overseas, we were ticketed to, I think, it was pretty obvious that we were supposed to go to a location in the Pacific. We were shipped to Fort Lewis, Washington. And from there, we were supposed to be shipped overseas to some destination which we were never told. And what became clear to us after a while, when we were not shipped over, that is that we were going through a second basic training course. Only this time it was an infantry basic training course. And so we were issued weapons. We did fire for record on the firing range. We did go through the infiltration course. We did 25-mile hikes with full field pack, steel helmet, rifle, and bayonet. And we did do bayonet drill, so I knew how to kill somebody with a bayonet. And so I asked myself, well, I'm supposed to be a medic. I'm not supposed to do this. And we were never told why we were doing this, but in retrospect, it seems pretty clear to me that they were beginning to be very worried. This was about the fall of 44, and the Germans were mounting this drive that was going to lead to the Battle of the Bulge. And so the American Allied, more generally, troops were being pressured. They were under considerable pressure because the Germans were just throwing everything into this attack. And so I think that we were being trained to be replacement troops, infantry troops. But by the time we got through that basic training course, I think the tide had turned and the Allies were again in control of the situation. The Battle of the Bulge was over then. So that was around December, January, 44, 45, in that break period. And that's about when we ended our basic training. And so I think that they changed their plans again, and we were sent overseas to Calcutta, India, where we were assigned to take over what was called the 29th Medical Laboratory, which was connected to the Army Base Hospital in Calcutta. And so that's where I stayed for the next 13 months, working as a lab tech. So you could say that some of my experience in science generally came in handy. You know, it was when I had to look at somebody's urine sample to see if there are red blood corpuscles in it, I could recognize what a red blood corpuscle looked like, and we were trained in the medics to take blood samples. So if they brought in, if the MPs brought in a drunk late at night, we always had to be somebody in the lab prepared to wake up out of a sound sleep and take a blood sample out of a guy. And one night they brought in a guy who must have been 6 foot six, and he must have weighed 300 pounds. And they had two rather smallish MPs trying to control this guy, and he was very angry. He saw me standing there with his syringe. I thought he was going to take my head off. Anyway, they finally had to club him into submission in order for me to get a sample out of him. And anyway, so that was my contribution. It was not a very big one to the war effort. I should say that at one time I did try to get into the Air Force, but that was in 43 when I was still in college. And I was, the war was very, it was a central thing in those days. And I was very crazy and sort of determined to get into it in some direct way. But my eyesight was it wouldn't allow me to go in the Air Force, so that was not. I also tried to get into the there was a meteorology program that you could be trained to become a meteorologist. I was rejected for that also, so I just waited for them to draft me to tell me what to do.
Well, City College had a program where guys were coming in to be trained.
V-12 or something like that. Yeah, they did have a V-12 program, and they had an ROTC program. But I was never sent back to college then, and I mean, I didn't know how to do that. And I think you had to go into the Army before you were sent back for V-12. And I was in the midst of my studies, and that was kind of a diversionary thing, and so I didn't get into that. In any case, that's not what I wanted. I didn't want to go to college in the Army. If I was going to go to college, I'd try to stay in and finish as a civilian. If I was going to go into the Army, I wanted to be in it. But
you came out of the Army, and I think you got married right away.
3 weeks.
Yeah, and I assume you had met your wife.
Yeah, we had met before, and we'd met in 42, actually, and we'd been keeping company for... until I went, it's almost 2 years, and by then there was kind of an understanding. We didn't have a formal engagement, but there was an understanding, and so she was working full-time then and didn't have time to prepare the wedding, and since I had just been released and school hadn't started yet at Columbia, which is where I was going to go, the problem was dumped in my lap, and I had to make all the arrangements for the wedding within 3 weeks. And how I ever did that, I don't know, but we did it.
It was a small wedding.
It was about 120 odd people, and yeah, it was. I mean, families were involved. You couldn't elope or have a small wedding. It had to be a big deal. So it was.
We can talk briefly about the role of your wife in
Well, that's absolutely central. I mean, she's just the most important person in my life, and she is so strong and so smart and so calm and focused, and I don't really know what I would be without her. She has a way of just being in charge of situations that I've learned a lot from her, and I admire her tremendously. And besides the other aspects of being man and wife, she is really just a unique person, admirable in every respect. So was a student at NYU when I met her, and she graduated from NYU in 1945. She was Phi Beta Kappa there, and at one time I had dreams that we would go to graduate school together, and she was interested in biochemistry and I was interested in chemistry, so we thought that would be a match. But as time went on, she decided that's not what she wanted to do, and she really wanted to have a family. And so ultimately she didn't go to graduate school, and she worked for a while, she worked at Columbia. She worked in Elderfield's lab at Columbia on the anti-malarial project, and she worked when I was a postdoc at Harvard. She worked in the analytical lab at MIT, so she was a professional chemist at the bachelor's level. But then when we moved to Los Angeles, we had our first child, and she stayed home for the next 17 years while we raised those three children. And at the end of that time, we moved, that was just about the time we moved to Wisconsin, she went to graduate school in library science, and she got a master's degree at Wisconsin in library science. And when we came to Yale, she went to work at the Yale Library, and became associate director of the library, and ultimately director of the medical library at Yale. So she had a very high degree of responsibility, and I think she was just a terrific asset to that that whole operation. And she's retired, and she continues to do some volunteer work at the library, and she also does other volunteer work. Our children are now grown. The oldest is Ruth. This is going to sound like bragging, but okay, so be it.
Why not?
They're wonderful kids. Ruth is Ruth will be 50 in December. God, is that possible? She is an art historian, and she worked for a number of years at the art museums of San Francisco. And then she worked she was deputy director at the Zimmerly Museum in New Jersey, Rutgers. And then now she's gone back to San Francisco, and she is the exhibitions director at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. Her major scholarly field has been the Impressionists, and she wrote a two-volume catalog and scholarly reference on the first eight Impressionist exhibitions. It weighs about 20 pounds. And that work apparently has been very highly regarded, and just this past month she was invested as a Chevalier de l'Ordre des Arts et des Lettres of the French Academy. And so she's really a world-renowned art historian. So that's Ruthie. And then our middle child is David, who's a professor at Brown University in neuroscience. And he is he's very interested now. He's done work in a lot of different fields, but he's just now reached a point where he's made what is apparently a very important breakthrough in the mechanism of the circadian rhythm. What controls the circadian rhythm, particularly in mammals and presumably also in humans. And he has identified, apparently, a group of cells, and he's identified a pigment. He hasn't isolated it, doesn't know the structure, but he has characterized it spectroscopically, which is apparently responsible. It's not one of the visual pigments. It's a separate set of cells which produces a separate pigment that is especially apparently evolutionarily developed for the purpose of responding to the circadian rhythm, the diurnal changes in the light levels. And he's terribly afraid he's going to be scooped, because a lot of people in the field are working on it. He's preparing a paper for Science now, which I hope that he finishes up pretty damn soon and gets into publication. But it's really beautiful work and very, very exciting. So that's David. And then the youngest son is Jonathan, who is a show business type, and the most recent activity of his is as the field director for a pyrotechnics display company. They're called Performance Pyrotechnics Associates. They're based near St. Louis, and they do shows in connection with events, public events, dramatic presentations, the Super Bowl fireworks they did, fireworks, July 4th fireworks on the Schuylkill River in Philadelphia, that sort of thing, the massive displays. When Hong Kong was turned over to the Chinese mainland people in 19, whenever it was, early 90s. He did the display on a barge out in the middle of Hong Kong Harbor. And we have some photographs of that. He's very good at what he does, and we're very proud of him. So there are the kids, and they're all married now, and we have four grandchildren.
Of the next question, which is about children, that you've covered it all. When did you decide to go to graduate school, and how did you decide to go to Columbia?
Well, there again, ignorance was in control of the situation. I didn't really know what I was doing. I guess I, through the rumor mill, I don't know quite how, while I was an undergraduate, and also when I was in the Army, some of the people in our outfit were chemists. One guy had a master's degree in chemistry, in fact. So these people were a little more, maybe a lot more au courant than I was about where were the places to go for graduate work. Now, how did I decide I wanted to go to graduate school? Well, I just became aware of how ignorant I was when I worked at Hoffman LaRoche. And I wanted to put myself in a position where I was an independent operator, not a lab technician. Do you know what I mean? And where I had a PhD, because I could see that the people who had real fun in the lab at Hoffman LaRoche were the PhDs, not the lab techs. So Well, but basically, it wasn't that we were doing menial work. I mean, we didn't have to mop the floor or anything, but because we clearly did not know much about what we were doing, we weren't given a lot of intellectual responsibility. And the people who were calling the shots were the ones who did know what they were doing. So I said, well, it's pretty obvious that I have to learn what I'm doing. And the only way I can see to do that is to go to graduate school and get a PhD. So somehow, I don't know exactly how, I got the idea that the places that I was particularly interested in were Wisconsin. And where I got that idea from, I don't really know, except that, of course, it was a good school in those days, and still is. But why that came to mind, I can't remember. Harvard also was floating around out there as being a good place to go. And then my parents began to lean on me, and my father at that time, because my mother had already died, was very eager for me to go to school someplace near New York, because that's where he was. And so I chose to apply to Columbia. Well, Wisconsin accepted me. Harvard did not accept me. Their excuse was that they had a lot of people coming back from the Army who had been there as graduate students. That may have been partially true, but I suspect that I may not have been accepted there anyway. But in any case, Columbia accepted me. And so Bella's parents also were getting antsy about our leaving town, and so that kind of left Wisconsin out of the picture. The combination of pressures left me pretty much with Columbia as the choice. Fortunately, they did take me, and so I went there. And so again, you see these... This is not a highly intellectual decision. In fact, the most attractive thing that I knew personally about Columbia at that time, Columbia Chemistry at that time, was that Bill Daring was there. Now, why was he attractive? Bill Daring at that time was something like 1944. He would have been 27 years old.
You've read about him in Life.
I've read about him in Life in the Time
or
magazine,
was.
Yeah, right. Yeah, in Time magazine, right, and I said, this guy works on natural products. He synthesizes alkaloids. That's just what I want to do. So I'm going to Columbia, and he's certainly one of the people that I'm going to want to be interested in. Well, that turned out to be a mistake, because by the time I got to Columbia, the other two people in natural products were Charlie Dawson, who was working on the active principle of poison ivy, urushiol. Everybody who worked on that project got poison ivy, terrible cases of poison ivy. And I said, I had come back from India with a bad fungus infection. In fact, I had been sick a couple of times in India. I'd had bacillary dysentery, I'd had amoebic dysentery, and I had this fungus infection. And I was still carrying that around with me. And I said, do I need another skin disease at this point in my life? So that was the end of that natural product avenue. Another one was Elderfield, who, in fact, had worked on alkaloids when he had been at Rockefeller, but was doing very little of that at this stage. At this point, he was almost entirely involved in the anti-malarial project. So all of his work was synthesis of these analogs of anti-malarial drugs, in an effort to find, you know, it was typical medicinal chemistry research, making derivatives and having them tested. And I wasn't terribly interested in that. And so, faute de mieux, what could I do? I went to Daring.
Curtin
was there, but he was clearly a physical organic chemist. And I didn't want to do physical organic. I didn't even know there was such a thing. So I went to Daring and I said, well, I had taken his course, and it was very physical organic, no natural products in it at all to speak of. And I went to him and I said, you're not doing any more natural products work? He said, no. And so we talked for an hour about how important physical organic chemistry was. I couldn't really get him interested in doing any natural products. He didn't have any problems in that area. So I kept badgering him, and he finally thought of something. And there was some leftover residues from some work that Don Noyce had done on a natural products problem. Now, what this material was, I just can't remember. It was not an alkaloid. It was a... I don't know. It was somehow... I don't think they ever published anything on it, so I haven't even been able to look it up. I suppose I could go back and get a copy of his thesis and find it.
I should remember because I just finished editing Don Noyce's interview, and
I
don't remember.
All right. Well, in any case... All right, you may have it at home. Well, that was the project that Bill Dering gave me. Don had isolated some things, and he had worked on their structure. I don't know that they ever reached a point of sufficient certainty on the results to publish the thing, but in any case, what was left over were the things in the mother liquors that Don had, everybody knew was in there, but nobody had really worked on. So Bill brought out this flask with kind of some mud at the bottom of it, and he said, here, maybe you can find out some things that Don didn't have time to work on, and you'll have a natural products isolation and identification problem. Well, this was exactly what I thought I wanted, because that's where my interest had gone after I'd been in Hoffman La Roche. And so I started to work on this. Well, I should have known better than that. I mean, Bill clearly was not interested in this project. He didn't have any ideas about how to go about it. You know, you're thinking about 1947. There was chromatography had just been invented, and it was very crude. There was no thin layer chromatography. There was no gas chromatography. There was no liquid phase chromatography, you know, exchange chromatography. All of those things remained to be invented.
You probably had UV, and you had crude IR.
We didn't have IR until the moment I started research. We got the first infrared machine it was a single beam instrument. It was in Halford's lab. Up to that time, I don't know how they had been doing them. They'd been doing a point at a time, I suppose. But they got the first continuous recording single beam spectrometer, which was put out then. It was not Baird. It was, I can't remember even who they, may have been Perkin-Elmer. Probably the first Perkin-Elmer. Perkin-Elmer 12B or something like that. I'm short-circuiting the whole thing. I never was able to get anything out of Don Noyce's residues. And I worked 5 months on that thing, and it was total frustration. And I went to Bill and I said, you got to get me off this project. I want to do some chemistry. I don't want to fool around with these oils and tars. So he put me on another project, and that project was the one that constituted my thesis. What I meant to say with regard to infrared was that the solution of that problem, which was a structural problem, depended upon an infrared spectrum. And as far as I know, I was the first one to use infrared spectroscopy at Columbia to solve an organic structure. So that was my PhD thesis.
Yeah, I was kind of wondering about that problem, because essentially you showed that the structure in the literature was correct, but that some of the products of
the products of the structure were wrong. That's right. Yeah, so basically, first of all, the thing that go ahead.